Yeah, I'm just calling this a different kind of apologetics, which doesn't give you any clue. I'm glad Tracy mentioned the direction that this is going. You know, this is the traditional approach, isn't it? And I love this. I mean, I'm not complaining about it. I love reading, so I like looking at facts and finding information. And there's a ton of information that does back up Christianity. So I'm not saying let's get away from that, but this is the traditional approach. So, for example, somebody says, well, I don't know if God exists. And you say, well, there are plenty of reasons, and you go through a few. I don't want to take a lot of time on that today, but what if somebody asks you, why do you think God exists? What would be some of the logical reasons you could give?
Well, I look to the sky. I look to the mountains. I just see his handiwork. That's how it touches
creation.
Me.
Creation. Did all of this come about by accident? I mean, the human body and the way the universe just operates so well. Yeah, that seems like a tremendous argument for the existence of God. They call that the design argument. Very effective. It's been around for a long, long time. Anything else you could say?
I just wanted to be a little kid and say, because he said so.
Because he said so. Which gets us into another area, which is, how do we know he said so, which is the Bible, and then we'll talk about that in just a second.
Morality.
Morality. Yeah. Where do we get this idea that we ought to do things? So we'll talk about that later too. It's interesting because science is actually leading us back toward God these days. It used to be in a couple hundred years ago, you know, you had Darwin come along saying, oh, you can get everything started without God. And they've kind of given up on that. It's sort of the deep, dark secret. You don't hear it much from National Geographic and Time Magazine and places like that. But there are a lot of reasons to believe that there's a God. And so I'm not saying don't get rid of logic. It's still there. You can use logic. And you'll have people who ask you those kinds of questions. That's great. Just deal with these things. Why do we believe in miracles? I'm not going to take the time now for that. But there are plenty of reasons to not reject the idea of the supernatural and miracles. And we were talking, Steve brought up the idea of because he said so, and how do we know he said so? Plenty of reasons to accept the Gospels. I do want to stop for just a second on that one and have you think about that. Somebody says to you, really, you believe this whole book? It's 2,000 years old? We don't even know who wrote these things. It's probably hundreds of years later it all got put together. It's kind of the Da Vinci Code approach. I mean, that was real hostile to Christianity. If you ever saw the movie or read the book, the Da Vinci Code, this guy has no use for Christianity. And so he puts in the mouth one of the characters all sorts of anti-gospel ideas in there. And some people walked away from the faith. They said, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was all made up hundreds of years later. I didn't know it was all the Emperor Constantine. I didn't know that Jesus was married. Yeah, well, there are good reasons not to know that stuff because they didn't happen, but I mean...
In the words of Luke Skywalker, everything you have just said is wrong.
Yeah. Oh, you've seen the new movie. Okay. what would you say? Somebody says to you these kinds of things, or hey, the Da Vinci Code's shown us that the Bible's out of date, or the whatever. I mean, are there reasons to support the reliability of the Gospels? And again, this is not going to be the point of today, but just, I mean, what would be some off the top of your head kinds of things that you might be able to
I
say?
I wouldn't tell them. Everything you've just said is wrong. That the fact that the Gospels were not written hundreds of years later. They were written in the first century. It wasn't Constantine or things like that.
Yeah.
That we do have good evidence that the Gospels were authored by the names attached to them.
Exactly.
And if you know, we want to pull out that evidence, okay, pull out Richard Dawkins' book. Right?
Yeah.
The fact that we covered this in a series on the resurrection, just talking about how when you apply the principles of historicity to say, this is how we know a written work of antiquity is probably true, even if you discount any religious aspect, the Gospels fare very well in terms of authenticity when placed alongside any other work of antiquity,
whether
it be Homer or Julius Caesar or whomever.
Yeah, we've got more manuscripts to look at. Those manuscripts are closer to the original. I mean, you can make a bunch of really good arguments for the reliability. The information that's in the Gospels was stuff that only first century people would have known. So you can't make this stuff up hundreds of years later and get that kind of stuff right. Why do we believe in the historical Jesus? people outside of the Christian faith talked about Jesus existing. There are no really reasonable historians these days that say that Jesus never existed. And Tracy already touched on the resurrection. So all of these things are ways that you could logically talk about the truth of Christianity. Last week we talked about another way that you can approach it, and that's just using illustrations or examples or stories. So I'm not going to spend much time on that, but it gives people a chance to mentally see some kind of fuzzy theological point that you're trying to make. You know, Jesus did that all the time. He'd say the kingdom of heaven is like. So he'd take this theological concept and he'd bring it down to earth and say it's like searching for a pearl, or it's like looking for a lost coin, or it's like this prodigal son or whatever, and you go, oh, okay, I can see that. They told the story of the Good Samaritan. I mean, he had people in action doing things rather than just, God loves us. Well, what does that look like? Well, it looks like a dad who's lost his son, had his son turn his back on the dad and walk off and say, I want the inheritance now, basically saying, I want you dead. And yet the dad's watching for him every day. We know that story. And the kid comes back. He's got that little story in his head. He's going to tell his dad, make me whatever you want. I'll just be a servant. And the dad just shuts him up, just grabs him, gives him a big embrace. And Jesus says, that's what God cares about. That's how he sees you. I just love that story. And it connects ideas with emotions, doesn't it? So you got the theology, but you got the gut level reaction that you get with good stories. And Jesus did that all the time. Yeah. I often, when I talk about the Bible at school, yeah, I can get away with that at Palomar, even though it's a secular school. I just talk about it as literature, so we're okay. But I always tell them, you know, Jesus' stories often had kind of a trapdoor quality to it. People would kind of go along with the story and they'd go, okay, it's a nice story. And then Jesus would go, and they'd go, oh, and they'd fall through the trapdoor because he'd always surprise them. Remember the guy who's lying on the side of the road and all these good Jews walk past him and ignore him. And who stops for him? The guy the Jews hated beyond anybody else. It'd be like the good ISIS person coming by. You know, it's like, it would just make your hair stand on end. He'd say the Good Samaritan. Really? There's such a thing as a Good Samaritan? So these stories really shock us. And so that's the quality of good storytelling. All right, so that's all in the past. Those are things that you can do, and I hope you do them when you're talking to people. But here's a different approach. Let me show you an illustration here. So it's kind of a three-step process here. Throughout life, there are needs that we feel, needs that we think we need to have met. And so we examine something that we think is going to offer a solution to that need. And after we examine it, we look at it and we go, okay, it met the need or it didn't meet the need. So, simple example. Your teeth feel a little fuzzy. They go, my toothbrush isn't working anymore. You ever seen when they get all those bristles kind of falling apart? And so you say, all right, I'll give this a shot and see how it works. And you try it out and you go, hey, this worked. Now, that's a really simple example, right? That's nothing theological about this. But it's an illustration. You have a need first, and you go find something and see if it meets the need. And afterwards you go, yeah, I'm glad I got that. That met the need. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. What needs do people have? All of us, not just Christians, but I mean just the lost out there, the people that are not Christians, the non-believers. What are needs that we all share as individuals?
Sense of purpose.
You don't want to feel, and this bothers me a lot, I don't know how you feel about this, but kids in school today basically are being told that you're a fluke, you're an accident, this universe just kind of came into existence, there's no God. So no wonder, suicide it's a high rate among the young. They have their whole life ahead of them, you'd think they'd feel okay about it, but after accidents, suicide is the second leading cause of death. And a lot of kids are just checking out, what's the point? There's no reason to live. So purpose, anything else that you can think of is a deep need for everybody?
Physical needs, like food.
Sure, you have physical needs, you're right. So we're gonna focus today especially on the psychological needs.
You need to make a connection with other people.
Yeah, connection with others. Who wants to go through life as an individual, just totally cut off? We all want to make some kind of connections. Any other needs you can think of?
What happens when you die?
Yeah, but we don't want things to end. We don't want to say 70 years and, 70, I'm past 70. All right, never mind. Let's use a different number. 80 years and then that's it. You don't want to feel that way. You know, that dark thing out there that's getting closer and closer for all of us. That's not a good feeling. Any other needs you can think of?
Can I steal it off your sheet?
No fair. And by the way, this list that I have, is that's not all the needs. It's just a matter of time. So we're just going to keep it to the list that we have here. But would you agree everybody does share these needs? This is something that's going to be very easy to talk to others, because you know they feel the same way that we do. That's what makes, I'm in the area of humanities when it comes to literature and all, and that's what makes humanities, for me, a wonderful thing to teach, because I know my students out there share the same needs I have. We all have these same desires. We all want the same kinds of things. And so the humanities, you can read a story from 2,000 years ago, and the story still has an impact, because those people had the same needs. They dressed differently and talked differently, but we all shared those needs. So let me show you an example before we look at the positive things. I want to share an example here of a failed need. And it has to do with Christian Science. And there are plenty of failed needs out there, but this story really hit me. It's a story of a young man whose grandmother, they discover she's dying. And she's Christian Science to the core. She's spent her life in the church, and her husband, this narrator's grandfather, believed in it too. They were just really, really strong. He says, when I was in my early 20s, I again learned from firsthand experience the failings of Christian Science in the face of death. My grandmother became very ill. For months she sought a healing in Christian Science, but she weakened and she turned to the medical profession. Isn't that interesting? You're not supposed to need that, but she did. So right there you can see a failing going on. Anyway, I'm going to move ahead a little bit further in this. My grandfather and I sat at her bedside for 2 days while she died. Grandma Marie regained consciousness on several occasions. During these times, I looked into her eyes and sought some comfort or source of strength to deal with her death. But all I saw was death and despair. She was dying. She was scared. She didn't know what was going to happen to her. And I had no idea what to say to comfort her. I'd never experienced such hopelessness as in that hospital room. My grandmother expressed to me her fear. She sought desperately to cling to life. I didn't know anything I could say. Our local Christian, and this is the part that really got to me, our local Christian Science church offered no comfort whatsoever. In fact, not one person from the church even visited us in the hospital. They told me that they didn't want their thoughts to interfere with her healing. But I recognize this is just another sign of the reluctance of church members to face the reality of death. My grandfather sat in the hospital room with me and quoted from Mrs. Eddy. You know, that'd be Mary Baker Eddy, the founder. So he's quoting. That's kind of their scriptures. Claiming that my grandmother was not seriously ill. She'd get up and walk out of the hospital any minute. His heart, however, was not in it. Nobody could listen to my grandmother's increasingly labored breathing and not recognize that she would soon be dead. And that's the end of it. So, and you can get story after story like this where people have this need, in this case, life after death, the assurance that there's something out there and that you'll be part of that. And she didn't have it. And the church people didn't have it. And they wouldn't help her in that time where she really, really needed it. So there's a need that didn't get met. And I just think that's such a sad story to hear, and to think about that woman, those last hours being so agonized for her in the hospital. So there are plenty of failed needs out there. And what we want to do is we want to suggest to people that Christianity offers things that are so powerful that they will get interested and they'll take the next step. And at that point, then we can talk about why trust that it's real, why trust that it's legit. But we have to somehow show them that Christianity offers some things that are good. And I hate to say it, but would you agree that in the last, let's say, 10 years or so, Christianity has been smeared pretty badly? And a lot of people don't even want to examine it because they think it's negative. And I don't want to dwell on that, but I mean, what are a few of the negative things that have come out where people say, no thanks, I don't even want to investigate it? In other words, what are some of the negative stereotypes these days? Yeah. Is it Julia?
Yes.
Yeah,
judgmental.
Judgmental. Yeah. Uncaring. Cold. No love. We don't care about the downtrodden. We don't care about those that are, you know, sexually different than us or whatever it is. So we've got all these negative things, and somehow we have to say Christianity offers so many wonderful things, so many positive things. We've got to somehow get that negative stuff aside and show them some of the positives that Christianity offers. Or think of it this way, just what are some good things that at least would allow people to say, gosh, I hope it's true. Notice we're not saying it is true yet, just you hope that it's true, and then you look at it and say, well, let's find out whether it's true or not. Does it at least offer you hope? Christian Science didn't. So we're not talking today about intellectual arguments, just how does Christianity meet some of our most important needs, and that's where the outline comes in. So far so good, or anybody have any questions at this point? Does that make sense? So you may not even have to do any of this with some people. They may just be ready and curious, and they're intellectually aroused by whatever it is that you're talking about, and fine. So you can talk about the Gospels, you can talk about the existence of God, you can relate recent scientific discoveries. I mean, whatever it is, there are plenty of good sources for that. So if that's it, great. You don't really need this. But I'm guessing a lot of people are so skeptical and so reluctant, you may have to just talk to them about what Christianity offers. They don't know. We're in a biblically illiterate society today, aren't we? It's really sad. In my classes, I'll mention something that seems pretty obvious to me from the Bible, and after Mary, they don't know who Abraham is. They don't know Paul. They don't know any of these people, and I have to kind of give them backstories on some of this stuff. So a lot of them have this warped idea of what Christians are. Unfortunately, probably a few of us have added to that warped perception. But anyway, we want to clear the dust and clear the debris out of the way and say, no, it really offers some wonderful things. So that's what we're going to go through today on here.
You have to be careful that it's not a, I do this to get this from God. It's not,
right.
God's not a coin dispensing machine.
Yeah.
It's a result of what he's done, right?
Make
sure you couch in the right way.
That's true. Yeah, there are ways to say it better than other ways, I guess. Now, how about number one? There's a meaning that Christianity gives us that nothing in this world can take away. Suffering can't take it away. Job loss can't take it away. Money problems can't take it away. Health can't take it away. So let's talk about what meaning is. First of all, meaning is coming up with a purpose, and a purpose that seems significant to you. What are some of the meanings that people get from their lives? Not talking Christianity, but just what are some ways that people say, this gives me meaning?
Jobs.
Yeah, always jobs. Isn't that interesting? By the way, one of the first things you do when you meet somebody you don't know, you say, so what do you do for a living? Because you're going to put them in some kind of box or category based on that, good, bad, or indifferent. But that's often a way that we kind of label ourselves, isn't it? You know, I am whatever, and there's your profession. How else do people gain meaning?
Parenting.
Yeah. You hoping that your kids go out and do good things and make the world a little better, and then that provides meaning. You invested 18 years or 20 years or whatever it is.
Volunteering.
Yeah, volunteering. There's all sorts of great organizations that people can join. That gives them a lot of meaning.
It's like a legacy.
Legacy.
That your life will live on after even you die.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember you.
Yeah, well, how are people going to remember you? That's part of the meaning that you can gain. But the key is, I think, is that word significant. Can you have meaning without God? Yeah, I think so. So somebody wants to write the great American novel. So they write the great American novel, and people acknowledge it. So they get meaning from that. Somebody volunteers for the American Cancer Society or something, and they spend a lot of time doing that. Can that give them meaning? Yeah. Yes, but those meanings all come to an end, don't they? Maybe you invest in the kids, and one of them doesn't do the things you're hoping that he or she would do. That job goes away. And those things disappear on you, or they become less important, or the money isn't there that it once was. And, you know, we saw that bubble back in, what was that, 08? People lost homes and things like that. But if Christianity is true, which I think is really a wonderful hope, if it's true, there's some meaning that can't be taken from you. So can we shift over to the religious side? What are some of the meanings? How are you different? How is purpose in your life different because of Christianity, because of Christ?
I had an online discussion with someone similar to this and referenced our Declaration of Independence, where it said, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we have certain inalienable rights.
Mm.
And, you know, unless those rights come from a superseding transcendent source, they could be taken away at any time if society deems so. You know, we have intrinsic value
Sure.
As human beings, that cannot be taken away.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. See?
Well, back to the point before this one, the thing that came to my mind was that is you get meaning can come from being in relationship, right? The relationship is what transforms.
Yeah.
I remember, I love cars. I struggled with not having a car. When I was young, I had my kids, really young, just married two kids, and I was driving along, and all of a sudden, I realized that all that mattered about this car was that I could put my family in it. Because we were singing, we were having a good time. And that was all that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was what made, gave everything, it didn't matter. And so you come to the next point, and along that line, you know, when we think about Christianity, I think sometimes, do we really have that sweetness of relationship with God? You know, a lot of times it's, you know, we have some theology, we have some thought that, you know, we live forever, whatever, but to me, that's when I get to have those sweet moments with God.
Yeah.
That's really deep and meaningful.
A connection with the creator of the universe, isn't that amazing? Wow. The fact that we are eternal souls and that we can influence other people for their eternity as well. I mean, that's pretty amazing. That's meaning far deeper than just going out and writing a novel. People go, oh, that's a good novel. I mean, you can change people's lives forever. You've got a new building going on over here. Is that going to change kids' lives? Yeah, forever. And people have sacrificed financially for that, and they've prayed about it. And that's a big meaning, isn't it? That there are going to be generations of kids over there that are going to be influenced. And maybe some of you have done Sunday school teaching. Why do you do that? Because you love hanging out on Sunday morning with little snotty-nosed kids? I don't think so. But there's a bigger meaning going on there. There's something that you're willing to sacrifice for this big cause. We're part of a worldwide cause. That's pretty impressive. I just remember Sharon and I, years back, went up to Bodie. Anybody ever seen Bodie up by Mammoth? Yeah. So you go in there. It's an old ghost town from the 1880s or 90s or something. And they have a church there that you can kind of look into. And they have I forgot what it is, but they got a Bible verse up front. Somehow it gave us a kind of interesting feeling that here were people 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, worshiping the same God we're worshiping today. And reading the same book, singing the same songs, praying for each other. And you start thinking, wow, there's a big purpose, there's a big meaning going on here. Worldwide, people all over the place are worshiping the same God. I think that's really neat stuff. How about number two? Somebody already brought it up today, the fact of, I think Roger did, right? He talked about morality. Now, let's stop here, because a lot of people say, well, see, atheists don't believe in a God, so they can't be good. Well, that's not true. Some atheists probably outdo us, outshine us as far as goodness. Can you have moral goodness without God? In other words, could you act on your moral feelings?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think it's good to help the poor. Okay, that's a good thought. You think it's right not to lie to people all the time? That's fine. So we're not saying atheists can't do good things or have good thoughts or have their own little internal system of what they think is right and wrong. So I hope you don't ever say that or believe that. But here's the catch. Do you think, without a God, you can go up to somebody else and say, hey, you ought to do X or you should not do Y? See, there's the problem, because that person can turn right around to you and say this. Says who? In fact, there was a really interesting piece by a Duke University professor. I'll be glad to send it to you if you want sometime, but he was not a Christian. He's passed away. He's not a Christian. And he wrote a whole piece, basically the says who business, because he said, where are we going to establish morality? Locally? In Escondido? Is there going to be a city council thing? They'll say, this is now right and this is now wrong. You're going to say, well, that's nuts. You know, I don't, why would I trust you guys? How about the state level? Sacramento? Hardly a hotbed of morality. How about the United States Senate? They're going to pass a resolution. This is now correct and this is now incorrect. Really? They did that 100 years ago with the Dred Scott decision and said slavery was okay. So are you going to trust them that they're going to get morality right? How about the United Nations? No. So where are you going to go? And that's this Duke professor, he was saying, where are you going to go for this idea of morality? And he was searching himself. He said, we're kind of stuck. If we don't have a God, if we don't have a standard outside of us, if it's up to us, morality is either going to come out of a gun, right, out of the point of a gun, you will do this, or it's going to be 51% deciding. And I don't know about you, but I don't trust 51% to come up with correct morality all the time. They never have in the past. Why would you trust it in the future? But that's where we are today, if there's no God. Christianity, though, offers the reality of a morality beyond us. And it stood the test of time for generations. How about number three, identity and self-worth? I think somebody else mentioned that. We were talking about that as well. If you work, you get an identity in our society. I mentioned that before. So what do you do for a living? So that's nice. Everybody's got this identity. However, it really depends on your performance, doesn't it? The better you perform, the better your identity. We like you. You're okay. You're doing well in this job, so we'll keep you on. So you're being compared all the time with others. Job evaluations, finances, I mean, whatever it is, you and the rest of the world are in this competition. Now, how about Christianity? Is that based on competition? How are you evaluated?
Based on how well you know God.
That's
you
it.
Know God, do you know?
Yeah. So do you have to be a smarter person to be a Christian? Do you have to be a certain skin color to be appreciated as a Christian? Do you have to earn a certain amount of money to be appreciated as a Christian? All that goes away, doesn't it? There are Christians from all walks of life, from all economic levels. In fact, Christianity does really well, especially with the downtrodden, doesn't it? It's not an elitist kind of thing at all. But it's pretty cool. Our identity is set. I've seen lists of what we are in Christ. We are new creatures and we are forgiven. And we all these things that are true about us that probably on a typical day we don't think about, but we've got some really wonderful things. Anything else you can think of what we are as far as our identity in Christ? We're new creations. We are forgiven.
Free from the bondage of sin.
Ambassadors. We're ambassadors. That's kind of a cool thing, thinking about a new identity as an ambassador. Every time we walk out of here, we are apologists. I don't mean, sorry, that kind of apologizing, but we're all supposed to be carrying the message, and some of us are doing it better than others. So, that's a good point, ambassadors. What's an ambassador supposed to have? Knowledge, wisdom, and character. Those are three attributes. And so that's pretty cool if we've got those things going for us. Anything else you can think of that we have as our identity now?
We're his family. We're his sons and daughters. He adopted children.
Yeah, we're adopted into a huge family. That's pretty cool. We're brothers and sisters in Jesus. In fact, Jesus talked of God as Abba, which really the Jews were crazy about that. Go, what do you mean, Abba? He's not daddy. I mean, he's this fire and brimstone kind of guy, you know. But Jesus saw a much warmer relationship. Julie?
We're righteous.
Yeah. We're clothed in Christ's righteousness, not our own, but... Okay, so those are lists that you can go through sometime to kind of make yourself think about, well, what is my identity? How about number four, hope that changes everything? Do people want hope? Yeah, here's the catch. I mean, we want hope. We have a desire. So you go play the lottery. Well, you got the desire. I'm not sure you have the expectation. So I'm not sure the hope works there. You do want the money, but what are the odds? You know, you're going to get hit by a meteorite before you're going to win the lottery. So that's probably not a great example of hope. But Christianity offers us hope. Here's the catch. Look around. I already mentioned that today, but look around at our society. What's the hope in America today? I don't know. Where are people putting their hope? It just seems like we're kind of a land without hope these days. You know, for 30 years they tried this thing, the moral majority. Remember Falwell and things like that? And did that really change society? Well, I don't know. Maybe a few people got changed, but that seems to have fallen over. The evangelical movement... I don't know. Individual churches have done really well, but you know, the society in general has kind of lost the feeling of hope, hasn't it? We're back to the whole thing about why are we here? if evolution is true, if secularism is true, we have no purpose. We're all flukes. We're all an accident. And we got no future. We came from nothing, and we're going to nothing. You got your 70, 80 years, and then good luck to you in the ground. Adios. So I feel so bad for kids these days that are growing up hearing that. I mean, we can handle it as adults, but they're hearing that over and over again. And our hopes and our desires always get disappointed in this world, don't they? You can win that $1 million lottery. By the way, have you ever read stories of people who've won the lotteries? Mostly, maybe there are some exceptions, mostly it's misery. We saw a documentary one time, and they interviewed about a half a dozen people who had won. One person said, I got rid of it as fast as I could. He said, it changed my life, ruined everything. All of a sudden, he got lawsuits. He got people coming into his life. They were trying to drain him of all that money. His family avoided him or harassed him. They lost all their friends. They didn't know who to trust anymore. They ended up kind of bitter people. So maybe you've seen things like that. You know, oh, if I just had, and you find people that get whatever it is, they win the Super Bowl. That's not too far off. And whatever it is, they get this big thing, and then it's like, yeah, so? And it all goes away. So what do you get? You get people doing all sorts of things to capture whatever that it is without Christianity. In some cases, they just keep chasing it. Okay, I didn't get the Super Bowl this year. I'll get to it next year. And if they win it, they come back again anyway. How long is Tom Brady going to keep quarterbacking? So apparently he hasn't reached it yet. I mean, you're still throwing that ball still out there on the field. Or they get angry. They get mad because they didn't get it. Whatever that it is. They say, well, this is stupid. And they're really upset and burned out on life. Or they change things in their lives. They think it's my wife's fault. I'll get rid of the wife. I'll change homes. I'll change jobs. You know people like that? They're always running after it. And they dump things along the way that they think are keeping them from it. But they're not finding it. Or they detach from the world. They quit. It's not worth it. And they get real negative and sarcastic and everything's no good and the glass is always half empty. So maybe you know people like that. But what about Christianity? I mean, just think about the hope that's involved in Christianity. These are some amazing things. Now again, I'm not saying they're true. You're not arguing that with the world, but you're just saying, look at what Christianity offers. Good things will come true. Now what kinds of good things? Resurrection. Isn't that something? I mean, we go to funerals of Christians, don't we feel very different there than we do at a funeral for somebody who's not a Christian? Totally different. I've always felt so bad. I don't know how pastors here handle doing a service for somebody who's not a Christian. I couldn't do that. I don't know. What do you say? Nice life, nice kids, nice home. I don't know. I mean, that's the end, you know? But we say, no, there's something beyond this. Just recently, Nabil Qureshi, who's a Christian converted from Islam, and he had an amazing, promising future. He's a young guy, and he died from cancer. But he did some video logs from the hospital beds, and over again, he would talk about, this is not it, this is not the end, you know, I'm going on. And it was a really touching thing. But we all have that kind of hope, don't we? The world is going to be healed. This world is a mess. But it's going to be better. Jesus is coming back. What a wonderful thing to think about. Our souls and our bodies are going to be saved. You can't get this kind of thing from a secular perspective. They don't have this kind of hope. I should have brought this quote in for you. I forgot. I think it was Richard Dawkins who said, my mind and all my thoughts and everything about me are in my brain. And that's all there is to me, and when I die, it's all going to rot. At least he's honest. But I thought, boy, there's a real inspiring thing, right? Put that on your refrigerator every morning. That'll get you through the day. And then number five, how about awe and inspiration? You know, materialism, meaning just this stuff, right? This is all there is to the universe, and science have really taken away the idea of awe and mystery. There's something, it's called reductionism. We're just nothing but a walking bag of chemicals. And we don't have a mind, we just have a brain. So we're just like sophisticated computers. And you're saying, really? What happened to awe and an inspiration out there in the world. You see a sunset and you think, thank you, God. But the secularist is going to look at that and say, interesting wavelengths. It's like, well, that doesn't provide much inspiration, does it? Yeah.
I was going to say, anyone who's had children, you have that newborn baby.
Oh,
you know, just
yeah.
The awe of a new life. And
yeah.
You can't just say, oh, well, that's just...
Another organism.
Yeah.
Think about this, and we've already touched on it today a little bit, about the design that's in this universe. If you don't believe design happened, you're just saying, well, that's interesting that all that stuff came about. But shoot, there's DNA is an alphabet. It's a language. It's going on inside you right now. And your cells are inside your cells. It's reading that language and creating new proteins, doing all this crazy stuff. And you just have to say, well, it's just a fluke. We're just lucky if you don't believe in a God. This is a God of love, very different than Allah. Here's a God that cared about us. We worship the only God who has wounds. You ever thought about that? That's pretty neat. He stepped into our world, gave up this divinity. I mean, talk about awe-inspiring. And he came and he hung out among the human race. And then he trusted us enough, he went back to heaven and said, you take care of it from here. And he turned it over to 11 kind of poor examples. I always like Peter, he's more like me, kind of a screw-up. So, but he turns us all over to these people and says, go out and make a difference in the world. And they did. They turned the world upside down. How about have we ever thought about the value of the Bible? I know we lug it around all the time, but the value of the Bible and how amazing the Bible is. The history that's in the Bible. I mean, I'll just give you one example. The Bible mentioned a group of people called the Hittites. There are a lot of ites. All right, so there's a group called the Hittites. And at one time, people read it and they said, this is just made up stuff. There's no such thing as the Hittites. We've only found them in the Bible. So now guess what they've discovered? The whole Hittite Empire, it's up in Turkey. So, okay. But there are dozens of these examples. The Bible is an amazing piece of history. It's cool just reading it for that. Sennacherib, the guy that invaded and came to Jerusalem and surrounded Jerusalem, he's got a huge stone monument that talks about going to Jerusalem and doing what he did. So, I mean, there's all this wonderful history that's in the Bible. The Bible gives you a big picture of life, doesn't it? It says what life is about. It says where we came, why we're here, what happens to us later on. It answers all those big questions that everybody has about life. It's a worldview. It's not just a book. It tells you the whole picture of life. The unity of the Bible is amazing. You ever thought about that? It's written in different languages, written by tons of different authors, written over hundreds of years, and yet it's one story. How would that happen? Has that ever happened in any other religious book or any other book at all? That it gets put together from different continents, gets put together by different authors, different time periods, and yet it creates the same story? How is that possible? That it hasn't happened.
Do you? Share one thing that I learned at the Crescent Project conference. The Quran, and I didn't know this, the Quran is it's not cohesive. If you haven't read it and you don't know, it's not a readable book. And it wasn't even like put together that way. It's little snippets of disconnected things.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Yeah. And then part of the Quran, the later part, abrogates or negates the first part. So if you're ever around Muslims who talk about what a wonderful, peaceful religion is, they're quoting from the first part, and then they don't quote from the last part, which says, strike them, hit them, do whatever you can to them. So, yeah, it's a very different kind of book. But the Bible is unified. It's the same story all the way through. The other thing is prophecies. Now, of course, at Christmas time, people tend to focus a little more on the prophecy, but there's some amazing prophecies. You ever looked at the Daniel prophecy, where it talks about the number of years? And you work the years out, and it comes to the time of Jesus. I mean, it's just really amazing stuff. Isaiah 53. Take that to a good practicing Jew and say, who's this? And they'll say, Jesus. And then you tell them it's Isaiah. It's so accurate that in many Jewish calendar readings where they go into their synagogue and read that, they pull it off. They don't read Isaiah 53. Because it confuses the congregation. Yeah, because it's Jesus there. Then you read Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And you read through that and you go, that's crucifixion. But they didn't have crucifixion when David was talking. So how did he know all that stuff? I mean, there's just amazing prophecies. In Micah, it says Bethlehem, and it says his goings are of eternal. goings. You know, in other words, this is not just a baby being born. This is some eternal being that's coming into this world. So you got all these amazing prophecies in the Bible. Look at Ezekiel sometime. It talks about Tyre and Sidon. It makes these prophecies about this city called Tyre that were fulfilled hundreds of years later by Alexander the Great. He carried out what the Bible was talking about. Specifically, what would happen to that area? And of course, change lives. Probably some of you, I don't know many of you very well, but I bet some of you have some terrific stories about a change in your life, awe-inspiring changes because of God. We were talking to a couple last night. Well, I've got to go fast on this one, but talking to a couple last night. He came from a Mormon background, and then he got married, and his wife was interested in Christianity. He said, yeah, but we got to go check out Mormon churches and all. So he went to a Mormon church and sat there. He said he heard a voice. He said, and this guy is a real hard-headed person. He's not, you know, kind of emotional type. He said he sat there, and he said he heard a voice saying, this is not the church for you. Isn't that wild? There's a guy that comes to our apologetics class that swears, he was a cop, and he swears that he interacted with an angel. So, I mean, there are things going on. You guys probably have stories like this of miracle answers to prayers and changes of lives, just completely, radically different people after they became Christians. So there are a lot of reasons for us to have awe and inspiration because of the Christian connection that we have. And then, okay, I'm going to have to hurry up here a little bit. An end to guilt. We talked about that, I think, before, didn't we? Somebody brought up something about the feeling of guilt. We all feel guilty. That's one thing we're sure when we're talking to a group or involved in a group. Everybody feels guilty, and we try to get rid of it. And so we spend money. And we buy drugs or whatever it is and try to take care of this guilt problem. We can't even live up to our own standards, can we? Forget, you know, I try to follow the Bible. Really? I try to go by the Ten Commandments. Really? If we're honest with ourselves, we say, well, I don't want to do this, and we go right out and do that. Or I should have done. How many times do you say I should have? We all do that. So Christianity says, you know what? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. How's that for a novel idea? It's not our parents. It's not society. It's not genetics. We're guilty before a holy God. And the answer is probably not therapy and drugs and hours on a couch, but forgiveness, which is offered in Jesus. What a wonderful thing. And I know people who have had lives that are pretty miserable and became Christians, and that guilt is gone. Now, they may have the memories of what they were involved with, but the guilt is gone. And then we'll wrap it up here. Would you agree today that people are often hitting heads against each other and there are all sorts of problems going on as far as how we treat each other? What to you are some of the worst things that you see in the paper or you just know as far as things we've done badly with each other?
Hillsboro Baptist.
Hillsboro Baptist, yeah, the ones that say burn in hell and they go protest soldiers who have died for the country and yeah, that's really sad. What else?
I just think the way we talk in general out in the social media is...
Oh, it's vicious.
It's in text form. But I think it's even... Yeah, I think just the cussing. And, I mean, it's just all commonplace now.
Well, I think especially because you're not face-to-face anymore, you say things that you wouldn't say if the person was right there. It's real mean-spirited. Yeah.
Well, just piggybacking, just categorizing it as bullying, especially among younger teenagers. I'm a high school teacher.
Oh. Yeah, kids know better, but that stuff goes on. Now, I just mentioned a few things. Sex slavery, religious bigotry, all sorts of things. But Christianity, what about Christianity? It's not based on works. Why would we put down somebody else? Now, think if you're in a different religion. Let's say you're a Muslim and you go through those five pillars. Then you do all those things. You go on the Hajj and you give alms and you pray five times a day. You do all these things. Doesn't that make you start feel like you're doing pretty well and these other people are morons for not doing all the stuff you're doing? There's a feeling of superiority in all these other religions because I'm working at it and you're not. You're not there yet. You haven't done the Hajj, huh? I'm ahead of you. It's not based on works. There's no pride for accomplishments. Others actually who are not Christians might be better people than we are. We're not saying we're superior. And somebody put it this way, I like this, we're just beggars that are telling people where the food is. And what I like about Christianity, it's a multicultural religion. It was the first, and it's still the biggest multicultural religion there is. Every continent has Christians. It's booming in China. It's booming in South America. It's booming in Africa, in South Korea. You know, it seems kind of dead around here, but if you look at the big picture, it's all over the world. It's the most multicultural group. Because we're saying it's not a racial kind of thing. It's a relationship with Jesus. And we all say we're created, I think Tracy brought that up, we're all created with the image of God. So that it puts us all on an equal footing. That's some tremendous stuff. So, yeah, are there good intellectual reasons? Sure. So I'm not putting that down. I'm not saying avoid that. If you can, get into those kinds of conversations. But look at these yearnings that it gives us. Meaning to life, standard for morality, self-worth, identity, offering us hope, and thrilling the soul, and then ridding us of guilt, and finally treating each other with respect. So, and this is just a portion. I mean, there are many more things, but Christianity is the greatest gift given to the human race. And we need to be able to talk about that when we talk with other people.